From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it took 11 months, 30 days, 18 hours, and 18 minutes, but the state of Illinois now has a budget again. Last night, Republican Governor Bruce Rauner signed a stopgap budget to keep the government running for 6 months and schools open for a year. The agreement between Rauner and Democratic leaders of the Illinois General Assembly follows a year of stalemate and was praised yesterday by Speaker Michael Madigan.
We can't pass a budget when the governor's demands relative to his personal agenda that hurts families are dropped. That happened here today.
But Governor Rauner was quick to signal the fight is far from over.
I believe and I firmly hope that right now we've hit the bottom. This is the low point in the evolution of Illinois. And now we begin to move up.
Tony Arnold covers Illinois politics for WBEZ in Chicago. He joins us now. And Tony, before we get to the compromise, remind those who have not been following this so closely how Illinois managed to go a year without a budget in the first place.
How we got into this, Governor Bruce Rauner took office last January, and he's a Republican. And when he was elected, he's going up against a Democratic supermajority in both the House and the Senate and the Illinois General Assembly. And so he came in saying he would do two things. One, not sign an unbalanced budget. And two, really pushing hard for various economic reforms, which many have seen to be pro-business, anti-union. These are things like limiting collective bargaining over the course of time, right to work was a version of this earlier, and also things like workers' compensation. He's even pushed for things like term limits and redistricting reforms for legislative boundaries, which is a direct attack on the Democrats who run the General Assembly, who have been in power for 30 years.
But he's not getting any of those things in this deal, right?
He's not getting any of those things. What you heard there was the House Speaker, Michael Madigan, who's been kind of Rauner's chief rival throughout this past year since he took office, who said quite clearly that this compromise happened because Rauner took this agenda of his that he sees as anti-union, anti-worker, off the table. And so this is this the whole reason that we're having this 6 month budget now that takes us through the November election is because Rauner dropped these demands.
But as you say, it's a 6 month budget, not a 1 year budget. What happens in 6 months? Do we end up right back where we started?
That's a great question. What's the consequence of not having a budget for the year? Has really affected just about every reach of state government services. In particular, those that have been hardest hit have been human service providers, both in the nonprofit sector and in the for-profit sector. These are services that serve seniors at their homes instead of putting the seniors in nursing homes or adults with developmental disabilities. They serve homeless youth, breast and cervical cancer screenings for people who can't afford it. Any variety of these types of services have been affected, either cut over the past year. Layoffs have affected many of them. The public university system throughout the state has been really decimated. Right. A lot of layoffs there. And so now what the 6 month budget does is give some money to those services. But there's been so many bills that have been accumulated that the state's debt has almost doubled. It's really the past year has been really brutal to the state's economic climate and to its just what the government owes now for all these services that it did not pay for the past year.
So what's the political fallout from this?
Well, Speaker Madigan, he had a contested primary, Democratic primary, that he won. Again, he's been in office since 1970, so he's been around for a while and been Speaker for almost 30 years now, more than that. And so he's going to be winning in the fall. I don't think he has even a challenger for the fall election. Governor Rauner's up for election in 2 years. Rauner's hoping to take away some of this Democratic supermajority that's in place in both the House and the Senate. At the root of this is honestly, like they both think that they have a winning argument on their side. One is that Illinois' economic issues have been around for years, and Bruce Rauner says he has the solution to these problems. They are more business-friendly reforms. Democrats say he's come in and been been such an obstructionist that the state's worse off than when he found it 18 months ago, which is no small feat considering the financial problems that have already been facing Illinois for the past several years. So they both think that they have winning arguments, which has only contributed to the length of this overall budget stalemate.
That's Tony Arnold, state politics reporter for WBEZ in Chicago, as they finally have a budget, at least for the next 6 months, in the state of Illinois after a year without one, or just about a year. Tony, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, today, Attorney General Loretta Lynch said she expects to accept the recommendations from the career lawyers and FBI agents looking into Hillary Clinton's email server. Now, this was in response to the outcry over her role in the investigation after a private meeting between Lynch and former President Bill Clinton at an airport in Arizona. Here she is with more about her decision this morning.
And the most important thing for me as the Attorney General is the integrity of this Department of Justice. And the fact that the meeting that I had is now casting a shadow over how people are going to view that work is something that I take seriously and deeply and painfully.
But did she move that shadow? Did she put out the fire raging over this? NPR's justice correspondent Carrie Johnson joins us. And Carrie, Attorney General Lynch alluded in her sit-down in Colorado, the gathering was the Aspen Ideas Festival, she alluded to the notion that a lot of people don't even know what her role is in all of this. Did she answer what that is?
So the Attorney General, Robin, more or less indicated that this case is going to operate like almost every other case before the Justice Department, whether it involves the presumptive Democratic nominee for the White House or a low-level drug dealer. In other words, the case is being led and has been led from the beginning by a team of independent career prosecutors and FBI agents, people who do not lose their jobs when an administration changes, and that their recommendations will move up the chain of command all the way up to the FBI Director James Comey and to the Attorney General Loretta Lynch. What Lynch said today was she fully expects to follow the recommendations of those independent officials in the Department of Justice.
But she also said in this interview today that there was a review that would happen, and that immediately sets off alarms. Well, are you going to review it and then maybe overturn it? I mean, did she answer questions, do you think, or maybe raise more?
So the way these processes work is that in any case, Robin, senior officials review the work of lower level officials. What Lynch said today very clearly was she does not expect to have to overturn or overrule the findings of these lower level folks. And that doesn't happen very often at all. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue is she's talking about this now. And the only reason she may be talking about this now, Robin, is because of this kind of bizarre impromptu meeting with Bill Clinton on the tarmac in Arizona on Monday, which, as Lynch said herself, cast a shadow over the integrity of the Justice Department. She wanted to make clear today, yet again, that in her view, the meeting with Bill Clinton involved golf games and conversations about grandchildren, conversation about former Attorney General Janet Reno, nothing about this email server investigation or any other law enforcement matter. And she felt the need to come out today and come out strong to explain that because of the notion that Democrats and Republicans in Washington and elsewhere have raised some questions about the political nature of this Hillary Clinton server investigation.
Yeah. Well, and she said that maybe that was a mistake, but having that meeting. But, you know, again, in saying that she's going to accept the decision of the career lawyers and FBI agents. A lot of people, just because of all of the chatter about this, all the morning shows, television morning shows opened with the hoopla over this, a lot of people thought that it was Loretta Lynch that's sitting there going through emails and evidence. She is not. She was only going to receive the decision from those career lawyers. Since that was what she was only going to do anyway, has anything really changed?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the Attorney General attempted to tamp down some of this speculation and maybe put out a fire as to the politics of this matter. But let's be honest, Robin, this is a long-running investigation involving the server of a woman who's running for president when the convention for the Democratic Party is happening in a few weeks. And politics was always going to be surrounding these matters. What Attorney General Lynch said today was that she is not involved in the nuts and bolt of this email server investigation. She can't even predict when it's going to be done. But the long and the short of it is, in a Department of Justice with 100,000, 110,000 employees, it's very rare for the attorney general to get involved in the nuts and bolts.
Well, but will this, and very briefly, mute the calls from some Republican senators for an independent prosecutor?
No, it will not. This is a matter fully in the political sphere and conversation now. And as the party conventions, both Democratic and Republican, occur in a few weeks, I expect this to be an issue.
NPR's Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Let's go back a bit to 1929. The hugely popular John Philip Sousa greets listeners on an NBC broadcast introduced by American composer Deems Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. This is John Philip Sousa, and I'm very glad to be here with my band representing my own country, America, on this international program.
Sousa was a rock star then and will be again on the 4th, as he is every year. You'll hear the Stars and Stripes Forever wherever you go. You might remember we deconstructed the piece with Sousa expert Keith Bryan a few years ago.
In Stars and Stripes, is all of this light pickup from the bow. It's very natural with an orchestra, not so natural with a band.
In a second visit, Keith dropped the bombshell that John Philip Sousa did not like the 4th of July. What? We want to reprise that conversation today with Keith, a Sousaphile and director and founder of the new Sousa Band, and the force behind a project to record all of Sousa's music for band. Keith is on volume 17 and 18 with about six or so to go. He's also writing a book about Sousa, which is set for publication next year. And I've watched him write it on the porch. Full disclosure, he's a neighbor. We're hoping he'll organize a little march around the block this weekend. Anyway, here's our visit with Keith Bryan. So Sousa, such a part of the 4th of July, but it wasn't that big a part of his life, you say.
No, you know, it's just like Christmas years ago. It was not a big deal. I suppose you could say it's been commercialized, but it's still a great patriotic holiday. However, in Sousa's time, it wasn't observed with the ferocity that it is today.
He was born in 1854, died 1932, just a few years after that recording we just heard. And you looked at all the times that he actually played on the 4th.
About six times. Most notably, in 1900, the first time that he took the Sousa Band to Europe, he played in Paris for the Paris Exposition. And he played this great march, Hail to the Spirit of Liberty, which he wrote for the occasion, dedicated a statue to Lafayette, and the rest is history.
Like it.
It's fun.
But Keith Bryan, why is it that the Stars and Stripes, do we know, ended up the one that everyone chose to be the song for the 4th, America's Holiday?
He thought that this was going to be that march when he wrote it. He took extra care with it. He wrote it on Christmas Day in 1896 and fooled around with it for 6 months before he allowed the premiere, which was in Philadelphia the following May. Harold Schoenberg, the critic of the New York Times, said it was probably the most perfect piece of American music ever written.
Well, and it did become the official march of the country, decided by
Congress. Yes.
As you said, critical raves. We've listened to the Stars and Stripes with you. We'll link listeners up to that at hearnow.org, where you show us how he's got, it's like a math puzzle, how he's got all these musical cues in it.
It's brilliant.
Time. What else should we be listening to when we want to listen to something that makes us feel good on the 4th of July from Sousa?
Well, one of the most patriotic ones is the U.S. Field Artillery March, which obviously was written for the field artillery. It was recorded by Sousa during World War I, one of six, only six, that he conducted himself. He actually issued over 1,200 recordings with the Sousa Band, but he never showed up. He didn't really believe in recordings. So there are only six that he was actually the conductor. And this is one of them, the U.S. Field Artillery March.
This recording is you, Keith Bryan, and your new Sousa Band. Let's listen. To conduct his pieces?
It's wonderful. You know, my dad's business was renting public address systems. And so from the time I was three, he really wasn't interested in music. The only recordings we had in the house were Sousa marches that he put on for political rallies and parades and things in the background. And I would get to go along sometimes when I was 3 and 4 years old and put the needle on the recording. So it was kind of my cradle music. So it's difficult to say all of the reasons why it means something to me, but I grew up around it.
Well, and it's so muscular and percussive, I would think.
Oh, it's terrific.
Yeah. Although you've told us, going back to the Stars and Stripes, it's hard to get it to sound the way Sousa wanted it to because there's a dip in the music, for instance, that people don't want to do today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are all kinds of inflections that were more normal during Sousa's period. To the degree that I can, I try to bring them all back. How short a short note was, how long a long note was. If it had sharps and flats in it that weren't in the key signature, it got a little extra oomph. Mm-hmm. So all of those things are tricks. The snare drum has changed more than any instrument in the orchestra since Sousa was alive. So we have replicas of those old snare drums that we use. It goes on and on, every possible way we can find out.
You also told us that Sousa wanted to write marches that would make a man with a wooden leg stand up and dance.
Right.
So give us another one.
Liberty Bell would be good.
Let's listen. It is hard not to stand up and move. I feel like I know this one.
Yeah, well, it was the Monty Python theme.
Oh, of course. What do you think about that, Keith?
I love it. Well, why not?
Well, the fact that Sousa, though so serious about his music and it's got a serious intent, these are patriotic songs, many of them.
Yeah, it's a patriotic title. But it was really a piece that people danced the two-step to.
So people did have fun with Sousa. That was
the point. Of course.
That
was, it was about fun. It's very happy music.
So Keith Bryan, as we've learned from you, you travel the world to play with your band in other countries. Sousa's adored in China, in Europe. And you've brought a piece of music that's from the Royal Netherlands Navy, the Marine Band of the Royal Netherlands Navy, Yorktown Centennial. Let's listen. What's it like when you're playing at a hat shell or out on, you know, you can be playing in Iowa? What's it like when you look out on the people?
Oh, it's fantastic. You know, I've done the 4th of July concert in Chicago. To stand there and see a million people is pretty freaky.
And they're teenagers, they're kids in goth, you know.
The works.
What do you think it is? What's the appeal?
I don't know. It's in America. It's a time when everybody lets loose. They've got funny hats on, and you know they're celebrating.
But it's Sousa. What is it about him? Do you think that unleashes that?
He was patriotic to the core. His dad played in the Marine Band during the Civil War, so he was a little boy during the Civil War, if you can imagine. It just built into his fabric. And later, he became, during World War I, he became a lieutenant commander in the Navy, conducted a Navy band at Great Lakes, marched all over the country for raising money for war bonds. He was forever associated with the military and with Americana and America.
Yeah. Keith Bryan, founder and leader of the New Sousa Band, are revisiting us to just give us some other Sousa to think about on this 4th of July. And Keith, I just have to say, do people tell you you're starting to look a little like him?
I do hear that. When I believe it, that'll be a problem. But there's an Indian saying about walk a mile in another man's moccasins, and I've done that, and it's profound.
Yeah, and the moccasins belong to John Philip Sousa. So to go out, Keith, let's hear New York Hippodrome. Tell us about that song.
Right. People in New York will know that there's a Hippodrome parking garage. But in fact, the predecessor of Radio City Music Hall was on Avenue of the Americas, where the Hippodrome parking garage is today. Sousa had his offices there, and when he performed in New York, he played there.
And was it called the Hippodrome?
Yeah.
Well, we'll march out to the Hippodrome.
This thing has all of this New York energy in it.
Sousaphile Keith Bryan, director and founder of the New Sousa Band. We spoke last July. Happy 4th. It's here and now.
The upcoming Olympics in Brazil have been clouded by doping scandals, but many athletes, like one Texas runner getting set for the Olympic trials that start today, would prefer to just focus on the sport. Jimmy Moss of Here Now contributor KUT has the story.
Leo Manzano is a lot like other folks you might find around Austin, Texas. He drives a pickup truck, works out at the Y, and runs around Lady Bird Lake. That's probably where the similarities end. You see, Manzano's among the fastest runners in the world.
Here comes Manzano. Manzano making a late run, and Manzano gets the silver medal. Mark Luffy wins. Manzano in second place.
Before Manzano's 2012 silver medal, the last time an American earned that honor in the 1500 was Jim Ryan in 1968. Manzano will be looking to improve on that this summer in Rio at an Olympic Games already mired in several controversies.
It seems Rio has given up on its goal to clean up the water in time for the Olympics.
Reassuring athletes and visitors that the city is safe despite Brazil's ongoing Zika outbreak.
Russian track and field athletes may not be allowed to compete in this summer's Olympics.
The one that could linger over the games? Doping. Russia's track and field team has been banned from the Olympics. An investigation found systemic state-sponsored doping has been going on in Russia for years. And a couple of dozen or so athletes from other countries are also banned. And last Friday, the newly built Rio de Janeiro lab responsible for processing all drug test samples at the Summer Olympics was shut down because of technical errors that the World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA, calls disturbing. WADA spokesperson Ben Nichols says if the lab is not reopened in time, samples will be tested at an accredited lab.
Athletes can rest assured that the process will be in place that allows full doping control for the Olympic Games.
There are common types of doping in endurance sports. One way artificially increases your red blood cell count. That can be done by taking a hormone or reinfusing blood.
They take blood out of their body, let their body build back its normal stores of blood over the course of 3 weeks, and then after that, put back in the blood they had taken out and stored.
Ed Coyle is a professor at the University of Texas in Austin. He directs the school's human performance lab. By reinfusing, dopers are raising their blood volume 10 to 12% above normal.
More blood means more oxygen carrying capacity, more oxygen delivery to muscle, and much faster times.
There are also peptides, and then there is the steroid, probably the most commonly associated substance when people think about performance enhancers. So at the risk of getting caught, why do athletes dope? Ross Bumben is now a chiropractor specializing in sports injuries. He was once a two-time All-American in the decathlon at the University of California, Berkeley. He says the pressure ratchets up every 4 years.
Your big chance, your Wheaties box, doesn't happen other than the Olympics.
Which brings us back to the weight training home of runner Leo Manzano. Is he worried about having to compete against dopers when he knows the advantage they might have? In a word, no.
You know it's there, you just can't worry about it. Because ultimately, it's like, yeah, if you're that's all you're worrying about, you know, that's all you're thinking. And ultimately, you got to just step onto the track and race no matter what.
But first, Manzano will have to make the Olympic team. And he says he likes his chances.
You know, I feel really good about it. It's all I can say. I mean, everything else has to be taken care of on the track. I mean, you know, it's top three. So.
The U.S. Olympic track and field trials get underway today in Eugene, Oregon. For Here and Now, I'm Jimmy Moss in Austin.
And it's been a week of news about Britain's vote to exit the European Union, and we've heard a lot about what Brexit may mean for the nation's future. But how does this fit into its history? Robert Saunders is a professor of modern British history at the Queen Mary University of London. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, as an historian, as you look at Brexit, how surprised were you? How big of a deal is Brexit in the context of British history?
I think it's an absolutely huge deal. Historians love a precedent, and we've spent the last week desperately scrabbling around to try and think of something on this scale before. And the best people can really do is the collapse of the British Empire in terms of its impact on Britain's place in the world. The difference is that that happened over about 30 years and was reasonably well planned. This happened in 24 hours.
But you would say this is as big of a deal in the course of British history as the collapse of the empire?
In terms of what it means for Britain's place in the world and Britain's strategy, you know, this has overturned the entire course of Britain's economic policy, its foreign policy and its trade policy in one go.
Is it connected, in your view, to the collapse of the empire?
I think it's linked in terms of the big question. If you think back to Britain in the early 20th century, Britain was a global superpower. It had the biggest empire in the world. It was a manufacturing titan. And after 1945, as the empire disappeared, as Britain lost its place as a global superpower, the question was, what did Britain do next? What was the point of Britain? And the answer to that question for every government since 1961 was that Britain must join the European Union and lead in Europe. And so that option has now closed.
How has Europe influenced Britain over the last few decades as it's been a part of the European Union? What is Britain going to lose in terms of European influence?
I think we're only really discovering in the wake of the vote actually how intertwined Britain has become with the EU. It's Britain's biggest trading partner. It's its most important trade relationship, so that has to be rebuilt. But it's also become part of the law of Britain. Over the last 40 years, the British legal system and the European legal system have become intertwined, so we've got to now pick that apart. Things like regional policy, development money, support for the arts and culture and higher education, much of that has come from the EU. So all of that has to be rebuilt now from the bottom up.
And what about the other way around? How do you think British ideals have influenced Europe over the last few decades?
Well, one of the ironies of this is that the British always see themselves as the awkward partners in Europe, whereas on the continent, people often perceive a British agenda that has driven the EU for the last 20 years. And what that's particularly been about is the completion of the single market, making it easier to trade across borders, and particularly making it easier for service industries and financial services to trade across Europe. So there's been a more sort of liberal Europe as a result of British influence.
What brought the UK to be part of the EU in the first place? As you look back, what was the reason that Britain wanted to do this?
Britain came in rather reluctantly. So Britain didn't join at the start. The EU was founded in the 1950s and Britain stayed outside. And that's partly because Britain had such a different experience of the Second World War. Britain was not occupied. Britain was not defeated. It didn't have to engage with the questions of resistance or collaboration. And Britain was still a great power at the end of the war. So Britain originally stood apart. What then changed was that British economic decline by the 1970s had reached catastrophic proportions to the extent where governments of all parties felt that it was necessary for the British economy to be in. So this was never a great idealistic mission for Britain. It was always about the costs and benefits.
And there was always a healthy skepticism in Britain about the European Union. And in fact, you can go back to Shakespeare, who described Britain's waters as a moat, quote, against the envy of less happy lands. So it's been around for a long time. So do you think that the Brexit makes sense in that context, that Britain is returning to its real, true self, or that it doesn't make sense because for Britain's future, it should be part of this.
I think it taps into a recurring myth, but I think it's a myth rather than a reality. You quote Shakespeare talking about this sceptred isle, but he was talking about England, not about Britain. And England is not an island. So there's always been a degree of confusion about this. But I think it's true to say that the British think of themselves as being semi-detached from Europe. We talk about going to Europe on holiday or joining Europe as if that's a choice. And there's always been a sense that, you know, Britain had a destiny that lay across the waves, that was part of the Anglo-Saxon world. It had its special relationship with the United States. It had its Commonwealth and Empire. And so because of that, in a way, joining the European community felt quite provincial. It was a shrinking of Britain's ambitions in the world.
How do you think that history is going to remember David Cameron, who was the one who brought us this referendum in the first place?
Well, a year ago, he was the most successful Conservative leader for a quarter of a century. He had been the first since Margaret Thatcher to win a majority. He was the first since 1900 to increase his share of the vote while in office. Whereas I think this is going to mark his reputation forever now. This is the biggest policy failure by a British government probably since the 1930s.
That's Robert Saunders, who teaches modern British history at the Queen Mary University of London. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, you may have heard about the Baltimore judge who ordered a new trial for Adnan Syed, the subject of Serial, one of the most listened to podcasts. He's serving a life sentence, convicted in 2000 of killing his ex-girlfriend, Haemin Lee, in Baltimore. But the judge said cell phone tower evidence about Syed's phone, the time of calls he made, and whether it could pinpoint location, evidence that was brought to light in an offshoot of the Serial podcast, undisclosed, should have been examined at the original trial. Well, this has lit up social media. Danielle Belton is managing editor at The Root in New York. And Danielle, it said Serial doesn't really represent all podcasts. It's so successful. But what do you think about the news about a new trial?
Oh, it really shows the power of, you know, new media. Like, you basically have people using tools online to craft these new ways to tell stories. Stories have always been told, but in ways that are easy and accessible to people. Like, Serial had more than 100 million downloads. It won a Peabody. It has, a legacy now. I mean, it predates Netflix Making a Murderer. There's just a real hunger for these real-life stories in the public. And on Twitter, folks were really into the news that Adnan was getting a new trial. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people celebrated it.
Well, let's hear a little from the podcast Serial. This is Adnan speaking from prison, explaining why he thinks he's innocent.
I just sometimes wish, like, they could, like, look into my brain and see how I really felt about her. And no matter what else someone would say, they would see, man, this guy had no ill will towards her. Whatever the motivation is to kill someone, it didn't exist in me. You know what I mean?
Well, and now we should say that there were critics of the podcast. They felt that it was just rehashed techniques like, you know, Dateline and TV shows have been using for years, redoing trials. And there were questions about whether the audience became the tail wagging the dog, you know, that producers felt they had to put a podcast out maybe even when they hadn't finished their investigation. But still, here we are with a new trial. The Maryland Attorney General's office argued against a new trial. He said his office will defend the conviction. Haemin Lee's family at a hearing in February said they disagree with a retrial, but the followers online are certainly pushing for it.
Oh, definitely. I mean, a lot of people, Adnan's friends and family were on Twitter talking about it. And a lot of Twitter users admitted that they still thought he might be guilty, but felt he deserved a new trial because of the fact they felt that the podcast revealed so many inequities and problems with our criminal justice system.
So that's the chatter in social media. Another story getting a lot of response. There was a new Red Cross pool safety poster, which I think is already an old Red Cross pool safety poster. Explain.
Well, basically, the Red Cross, like, messed up in, like, the most bizarre way. Like, I don't even understand how this happens, like, in 2016. But basically, they created this poster that was demonstrating pool behavior, and it showed all these little kids playing around the pool. And the kids who were doing good behavior were labeled as cool, and the kids who were doing bad behavior were labeled as uncool. And coincidentally, all the kids who were uncool happened to be black or brown.
Yes. So how did social media respond?
People were livid. They, you know, immediately tweeted out the image and shared it, you know, across the board, talking about how this is, you know, an outrage. You know, how could the Red Cross allow this to happen? And, you know, the Red Cross was really embarrassed. I mean, they immediately put out an apology. They said we deeply apologize for any misunderstanding, as it was absolutely not our intent to offend anyone. I mean, still, though, what does that say about the Red Cross that the poster even got into production?
Let's hope it speaks only to a small office in the Red Cross. So, you know, because we know they come out and save lives no matter what you look like. Daniel Belton, managing editor at The Root, taking a look at some news stories filtering through social media. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Robin, Monday is my favorite holiday of the year.
Is it?
Always has been.
Oh.
Love the fireworks. Love the grilling. Love all of it.
I'm so sorry you're working.
I'll be working. But a lot of people at least will be relaxing and grilling. And you don't have to just do burgers, veggie burgers, and steaks. Kathy Gunst, our resident chef, is here with many more ideas. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
Boy, I mean, you can either call this our food segment or lunch.
Or your lunch. Maybe
this is
in
so
this
great.
Case, both. Yeah, I really tried to. My assignment was to stretch the idea of what you can grill. Mm-hmm. And you named some of the basics. There's all the seafood also. And we, as you know, have grilled lobster. We've grilled pizza. We've grilled steaks. We've grilled veggies. We've grilled everything. But I decided to try to play around with fruit this time and kind of unusual salads and side dishes. So I want to start with probably one of the things almost everybody will be eating this weekend, which is salsa. Mm-hmm. But most people will open a jar, and I beg you not to.
She begs you.
I beg you. Here's what I did. Now, I did not just chop everything up either. I took an onion. I took scallions, a shallot. I took the first ripe tomatoes. I took a jalapeno and a lime. Mm-hmm. And I coated them all with salt, pepper, and olive oil. And I threw them on a hot grill for a very short amount of time, under 5 minutes. Took them off, let them cool, chop them up, and this is what you have. This is my grilled tomato and onion salsa. You should have a little bit of char and smokiness from the tomato and from what the grill. And it's a completely different flavor experience.
It is. It's like a ceviche. I mean, it's not.
Yeah, or almost like a gazpacho because the tomatoes are so juicy.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was, and, you know, I gave them to you with tortilla chips. They would be amazing on a burger. This salsa would be incredible on any kind of taco or tortilla. It would be great with grilled shrimp, anything you want, but
fantastic.
It's a new flavor. It's a new way to taste a very favorite sauce.
I'm eating it like a soup.
Well, exactly. It's excellent.
Delicious.
Next up here, Kathy, we've got some mangoes on a plate with shrimp. And by the way, people can see what this looks like at hereandnow.org. You can also find the recipes. But what is this one?
So a lot of people are scared of mangoes, but they are so juicy and flavorful, and of course that spectacular apricot color.
Wait,
orange.
Wait, people have fear of mangoes?
They do, because they don't know how to cut them. So I want to tell you that I gave very explicit directions on the website for how to cut them, but basically you stand the mango up, you cut on both sides of the big pit, and then you make a tic-tac-toe board into the flesh, and you grill the mango. And again, you grill some onions, you grill a jalapeno, and you grill the lime. Grilling lime was the revelation of the week for me. It does, again, takes on a smokiness, but all of a sudden, you know how sometimes you squeeze a lime and it's like, not much happening there, the no juice? Tons of juice after it softens over a hot flame, but it's kind of a smoky citrus flavor. So I made a salad with the grilled mango and
Which
the jalapeno
is,
and the onion.
Isn't
and
it?
Then I added shrimp. Again, I grilled the shrimp, but I thought it needed a crunch and a fresh flavor component, so I added some thick slices of fresh cucumber and fresh cilantro, and it's a very Latin flavored summer dish. I just love it. I could eat that all day.
It is delicious, but you can't because we have to move
on. There's another one.
Yes, two.
Okay, another revelation of the week. It was a big week for me. Me and my
Very
grill.
Revelatory.
My grill and I really, you know, we got deep. We got to the next level. So I have these peaches. Again, peaches are just ripening. They're just juicy. And I thought, what if I just cut them in half, again, brushed them with a little olive oil, but grilled them and just drizzled a little bit of honey on to heighten the sweetness. And so the peach takes on a buttery texture, I think. And then I thought, what do I pair this with? I wanted something creamy, something rich. And I came up with burrata, which is an Italian semi-soft cheese. It's like a fresh mozzarella, but it's like mozzarella mozzarella on steroids. It's got a little sack in the middle that's filled with cream. So you've got the fresh mozzarella with the cream inside, and burrata is so rich, and the peaches just cut the richness. I just love the pairing. You could do that with fresh garden arugula, a good grinding of pepper, and then I just sprinkled a little bit of balsamic vinegar on it just to pop up that acid flavor.
Can you get burrata at the supermarket?
Yes, you can, and I did. I would look for an Italian variety. You, of course, could use fresh mozzarella as well. But if you can find burrata, you're in for something real. You could also grill cherries with that dish. Fruit really adapted so well to the grill. I was very surprised.
Real quick, because we got to get going here, but when you're grilling these, do you put them on aluminum foil? I mean, these are small.
I have a rack or a basket that you're supposed to put for shrimp or vegetables so things don't fall through. Highly recommend them, $10 or less. Make sure you clean your grill. Don't be cooking your peaches on the same place where you just had your burgers.
Yeah, well, people
you know, get it really hot
first,
and then take a good brush and just scrub it clean and get your fire hot, but not too hot. And always let the food sit for a minute before you start chopping it up or eating it. Like roasting, you want the food to sit, let the juices settle, even with something like a peach or a mango.
And if people, after hearing all this, still want to grill a burger or a steak, that's okay.
Go for it.
All right. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guns. We've got all the recipes at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks as always. Happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.